This isn't the formless void of a prison of the eighth dimension. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Damn straight, it's Junk Food Cinema, kids, and we are back!
And there was much rejoicing.
After a long summer vacation, a hiatus, it's been a long time. We shouldn't have left you without some junk food on which to chew, and that's why we're back. This is, of course, Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that is staggeringly devoid of irony. That's right. Irony is as unwelcome here as John Big Booty or his followers. I am Brian Salisbury, your host with the least, and I am joined, as per usual, by my co-host, my friend, screenwriter slash novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
It's pronounced Big Booty.
Big Booty. Big Booty, damn it. All right. And that's, I think we've pretty much clued people in as to what we're talking about today. But before I get into that, I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. If you just search for Junk Food Cinema in their podcast section, we're also on Stitcher. We're on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/get this, Junk Food Cinema. And then, of course, we do have those links at the bottom of the page there for every movie we talk about. If you want to do us a favor, if you're going to buy that movie, or if you're going to buy anything from Amazon, go ahead and use those links. Even if you don't buy that item, just getting to Amazon via that link helps us out, and we really do appreciate that. Well, yes, it is our month of sci-fi comedies. This is our first ever Junk Food Cinema curated feature. And we're doing sci-fi comedies because we thought, well, why not? Guardians of the Galaxy is making a shit ton of money.
Well, why not? And you, the truth is, you flipped your shit for Guardians of the Galaxy. And
I did.
I kind of want to sit around and talk about sci-fi comedies.
Yes. But you know what's funny is some of the best B-movies, some of the movies that really kind of define our love for this entire bizarre world of cult and exploitation are, in fact, sci-fi comedies. And today is definitely one of the paradigms of that. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across
the Eighth Dimension!
Quite a mouthful, quite an eyeful, quite an earful. Pretty much all of your senses getting invaded at the same time. This is, of course, a film that was directed by W.D. Richter. And W.D. Richter is a name you might be familiar with because he wrote this little movie called Big Trouble in Little China. As far as I remember, and I'm going to have to double-check this, but I think this may have been the only film that W.D. Richter ever directed. Yes, this is actually the only film. Well, there's a 1991 Late for Dinner. Okay, so I guess it isn't the only film he directed, but I'm not familiar with Late for Dinner. Do you have any idea what that is?
None whatsoever. Okay. it sounds like the sequel to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner that came like 25 years later.
Guess Who Didn't Show Up on Time for Dinner? The movie! Well, Buckaroo Banzai obviously is a film that a lot of us film geeks are really passionate about, and I think it has to do with, the challenge is to even sum up the basic plot of Buckaroo Banzai. I think in trying to sum up the plot of Buckaroo Banzai, you kind of explain what makes it so great, because you have a half-Japanese, half-American rock star slash surgeon slash scientist who discovers a parallel dimension existing right up alongside ours where aliens can actually communicate with humans. And then, of course, this is all possible due to an oscillation overthruster, which is a device of his own design. And then you have a mad scientist, a mad Italian scientist, who is out to steal or out to use the oscillation overthruster to open the doorway to the eighth dimension so he can bring so he can return to the 10th planet and rule it. That's the basic plot here.
That's the whole plot. It's like Guardians of the Galaxy that way, in which when you actually try to explain it, it doesn't take as long. It's all the setup to get to where it's going.
Yes.
That makes it pay off.
Yeah. And it's just like, it's a very improv type script, because you just find yourself saying, and then, and then. And every time you hit one of those and thens, it's another weird and wonderful little bit of this movie goulash. And I for me, I think that's what makes it so much fun to watch, is that it's all over the place in the most wonderful type of way.
Well, the thing is it is one of the purest and most beloved examples of what's now known as bizarro fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a name to describe a type of fiction that didn't really have a name until about the turn of the millennium. And existed on and off, and you can retroactively add a number of writers to bizarro fiction. But essentially what bizarro fiction is it's kind of a genre mishmash mm-hmm. of elements that are woven together, but that are completely absurd and woven together, but treated entirely seriously.
Yeah.
and treated with weight. You know, you can, you know, William S. Burroughs wrote a number of pieces that would be absurdist fiction, especially like his novel Exterminator. You see a number of movies over time that have some absurdist elements that make them bizarro fiction. One of the other best known examples of bizarro fiction is the adaptation of William S. Burroughs' Naked Lunch, which is actually not just Naked Lunch. It's four of his books put together, also starring Peter Weller, though. You end up with this weird, as I think movie goulash is a good way to put it. And that's
what, or at least movie ratatouille.
Yeah. And that is very much what Buckaroo Banzai is, in that Buckaroo Banzai takes all of these elements of comic books
mm-hmm.
And merges them with this kind of 1930s serial-esque kind of concept.
Right.
You know, the era of decoder rings and secret heroes and leagues of good, you know, listeners out in the world, ready to drop everything to come save the hero. And it merges that all together into one kind of awesome, nostalgic, movie that also is playing around with just a lot of bizarre science fiction tropes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're dealing with aliens and cross-dimensional travel. And on top of that, you layer a bunch of performances by some really great comedians. And you've got, you know, your aliens are played by John Lithgow and Christopher Lloyd. A number of other, you know,
Dan Hedaya.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lesser genre faves.
Well, I want to talk for a second. You know, you mentioned the origin of this, and I think what is really interesting is that its inspiration, like Buckaroo Banzai, is such, in and of itself, just the name of the main character is such a mishmash of things, because you have the quintessential cowboy persona mixed with, you know, the Japanese culture. And I think the two inspirations where the story of Buckaroo Banzai came from is another great example of that. It kind of really plays into it, the name of its hero, because it came from the Doc Savage pulp novels,
mm-hmm.
as well as the novel The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon, who also wrote Gravity's Rainbow. So, I mean, you have these two like really sort of bizarre bedfellows coming together to inspire the story of Buckaroo Banzai, which is a film that I don't think anybody was really ready for. Anybody really knew what to do with or what to expect. And yeah, I think, you know, one of its biggest assets is obviously its gargantuan cast. I mean, we've mentioned Peter Weller as the titular hero. And you have a number of it's up to its ears in great character actors. You have Christopher Lloyd, Clancy Brown, Jeff Goldblum, John Lithgow, Dan Hedaya, Matt Clark, Vincent Schiavelli. Like, it reads like a who's who of great character actors.
Yeah, yeah, no, and on both sides. I was mm-hmm. mentioning the aliens, but yeah, you know, when you get to the Hong Kong Cavaliers, the Hong Kong Cavaliers are all played, you know, almost entirely played by all these really great, you know, the new kid, the young plucky new kid is Jeff Goldblum.
Goldblum as a cowboy named New Jersey.
Yeah.
Like, this movie is a walking contradiction, and it's a number of things that just have no business going together, and yet it all somehow meshes. It all somehow gels.
Yeah. No, I had when you know, we decided to do this list, I went ahead and crammed and watched a bunch of the various sci-fi movies all in one night. And my wife hadn't seen all of them, or hadn't seen them since she was a kid. And she had thought she'd seen Buckaroo Banzai. And I was like, I'm telling you, you haven't seen this movie. And we sat down to watch it. Within the first 5 minutes, she's like, what the fuck is this? What is this? And she was loving it, but she's just like, already. And then, you know, the Buckaroo, you know, the Buckaroo and the Hong Kong Cavaliers show up at the show, and they, you know, and they start playing music. And at that point, my wife is like, this is just fucking weird. I'm like, I know, isn't it great? She's like, yes, but dear God, it's just, it isn't just absurd. It likes to soak and revel and roll around and wallow in its absurdity. And there's not a lot of jokes in the movie. It's all played straight faced, but it's a comedy.
Well, yeah. And I think a lot of the jokes come from just the sheer absurdity of what's going on, and things like characters' names that are never, like, character names like John Big Booty or Big Bootay. That are never, like, laughed at. It's the fact that they keep saying that name as if it's a normal name. Or John Smallberries.
Yeah.
You know, nobody makes fun of that in the movie. They just keep saying it as if it's a normal name for a person to have. And therein lies the joke. And I think that's the humor kind of throughout, is that everybody just keeps moving along with the changing absurdities in the story as if that's just a normal story to tell. I mean, when you have the president of the United States calling a rock star slash surgeon slash scientist and like, okay, Buckaroo, what should we do here?
And trusting him over his own advisor.
Trusting him over the minister of defense. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so bizarre, but in a way that you can't help but love it. It's a very indelible type of absurdity. And every time it switches, every time it makes a gear shift, the person who seems most on board with it is Peter Weller. Like, he never feels like he is out of his element. And I think that's what kind of carries the movie along, is that no matter what the new crazy situation is.
What are you saying, that no matter where you go, there you are?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great little nugget of wisdom from the great Buckaroo Banzai. Yeah, and you know what's funny is, I could watch an entire movie. If they made a sequel that was just about Jeff Goldblum's character in his bizarre, colorful cowboy garb. I mean, he looks like a nightmare Roy Rogers had after eating uncooked Migas.
But what would they call a Buckaroo Banzai sequel?
What would they call a Buckaroo Banzai sequel?
I mean, what could you possibly? I mean, how do you top a Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension?
I don't know. Maybe we should think about that a little bit, and we'll come back to that. But you know, I think as silly as its trappings are, at the heart of Buckaroo Banzai is some fascinating deep sci-fi, as you mentioned. I mean, the idea of, you know, there are aliens living not necessarily on other planets, but here on Earth in separate but parallel dimensions that we just can't see, is actually, like, really advanced science fiction.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
for a movie that is as goofy as this is, when you really think about what they're playing with in terms of their sci-fi conceit, it's actually pretty high sci-fi.
Yeah, no, there's I'm particularly a fan of the scene where they have the absolutely ludicrous press conference where they're explaining it, and they just so happen to include on the panel the woman they just got out of jail who tried to kill herself in a club the night before.
Yeah. By the way, that's in like the first act of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they have this press conference where they're explaining this very kind of complex concept, but they do it very simply and do it in a tongue in cheek kind of old school, 1950s B movie sort of way, where they have, you know, the reason why she's on the panel is so that she can go, wait, I get it. Yeah. I'm going to explain it to the audience in very simple terms. And she does that. And, you know, to wonderful comedic effect, but, you know, essentially they're playing around with, you know, bizarre particle physics in trying to explain not just, oh yeah, it's just some magical thing that we can't see. It's quite literally, oh, hey, you know, the atoms that make up our mass actually only make up one quadrillionth the mass of the volume of the object, and the rest is all empty space. So what's in there? Oh, hey, another dimension.
Yeah.
And it was, and it's really interesting how they play around with that. And, I mean, the thing is that they then take this high-minded science fiction and then put a classic escaped criminals, you know, escaping from the, what's the Superman's,
the Phantom Zone.
The Phantom Zone.
Yeah.
You know, it's Hitler escaping from the Phantom Zone.
I just want to make a movie now called Hitler Escapes from the Phantom Zone. Why has no one made that movie?
They did. It was called Buckaroo Banzai, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. And, It's Big Boute.
Big Boute.
But, yeah, so that's, it really is. It keeps, at moments, it gets very kind of high-minded sci-fi and then goes right back into the trough of absurd comedy. And it really is just one of those very strange, how did this ever happen movies?
Yeah.
And I love that Buckaroo Banzai is a Marvel Comics character. Like when you see when they pull out the comic book, because he has his own comic book in the universe.
Yeah. In the world of the movie, he is a persona that has his own comic book, that songs are being written about. Like he is basically like the coolest person on the planet.
So if for some reason, you know, we've gone through this thing and we've been talking about this movie as if, of course you've seen it. It's Buckaroo Banzai.
It's Buckaroo Banzai.
Who has never seen Buckaroo Banzai? But for those of you that haven't seen it, I mean, it really, what it comes down to is it's this guy who's great at everything. And he's just he was a neurosurgeon who got bored with that and became a rock and roll star and a particle physicist. And he goes from doing a surgery right to driving his rocket car through a mountain.
Rocket car.
On the same day that he's going to perform at a local club, with his band, the Hong Kong Cavaliers. And he gets caught up in, you know, what you'd expect, a dimension spanning adventure where he's got to save the planet from nuclear obliteration.
Yeah.
And it's just so goddamn absurd about every single element of it. And there's never a moment where anyone in the movie questions the absurdity of it, except for the Secretary of Defense, who occasionally is like, you can't listen to this guy. Who is this guy? But done in the way that he's the villain.
Yes.
You know, he's always the foil who, you know, that you have in most movies. He's the trope of the guy who, you know, is constantly working against our protagonist, even though he's not the antagonist, the chief antagonist. But he seems to be, the weird thing is as evil as he's portrayed, he's still the most rational person in this movie.
Right, and I think that's a really subtle little thing by the writers here, is that the one person who's like the slimy little worm character is the one questioning all of this, almost as a hint to the audience, like, maybe you don't want to question what's going on, because you don't want to be the slimy worm. Yeah. I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Yeah, no, everything about this movie is brilliant. It's a wonderfully executed, strange little movie that it's interesting to watch. It's so low budget.
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
It's so unrepentantly low budget. Except for its big action sequence at the end, you know, its blue screen effects, which were not cheap at the time. But most of it is done with plastic and neon lighting. Like it's very, very low budget, but at the same time, you see this really great design work by, you know, a number of just, you know, hungry young folks who are putting together some great effects on no budget.
Yeah.
That it looks really cool, but most of the time you could see how constrained the quarters are that they're shooting in and, you know, what they, you could see the strings practically on things. It is very, very much not what you expect out of that era. Cause where this comes from and where a lot of these movies we're going to be talking about this month come from is from an era of filmmaking in the '80s that is identical to the what's going on right now in cinema, in that, everything has become, about big budget genre, in a way that, that the studios are putting money behind very strange movies that ordinarily never would get funded. You know, nobody, you know, 10 years ago, nobody would have put a nickel into a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. And now they're just like, it's a talking raccoon and a tree and a green guy and a green girl and that guy from Parks and Rec. Here's $200 million. Give it a shot. Let's see if people like this.
Yeah.
And this era was very much about, you know, throwing, you know, shit at the wall and seeing what sticks. And this was one of those outliers that was just crazy enough to work at the time and got a number of young talented actors before they all hit. You know, none of these people were big names when this movie was made. Peter Weller was just kind of known, but this was one of the movies that really put him on the map. Ellen Barkin wasn't huge. You know, Christopher Lloyd was a TV actor at that point and hadn't yet become Doc Brown.
Nope, this was a year. Yeah, this was 3 years before RoboCop, a year before Back to the Future. So, yeah, we are still talking
Third
about...
Third Rock from the Sun hadn't happened yet.
Nope.
So this entire cast, you're looking at this cast, and this cast is a very exactly the kind of cast you'd expect from a low-budget movie. But when you look back on it in retrospect, you're like, holy shit, how did they get this cast for this movie? And that's exactly... It was just because they weren't huge yet. You know what? I wanna shift gears just a second. Have you ever noticed all the bizarre similarities between this and Back to the Future?
I did notice when they were looking at the diagram of the vehicle that that Lizardo wants to build looks almost exactly like the DeLorean. And then of course the cradle in which sits the oscillation overthruster does in fact look like the flux capacitor. So yeah. Yes, there are a lot of interesting similarities.
And of course Christopher Lloyd
is in of course
playing an alien scientist.
And at first
and on the back of the truck, mm-hmm. Have you ever noticed what the license plate is?
No.
Rocket, it's Rocket ROKIT 88.
88 miles per hour.
And so it was just ordinarily drawing comparisons like that would be kind of silly, but in that this movie came out a year before Back to the Future, it's just odd just how many little tiny similarities there are. You know, this super fast rocket car that goes fast, that has to go really fast so that it can pass through solid matter and go into another dimension.
Leaving two fire streaks behind.
Two fire streaks behind. And that it's that thing happens to have something that looks like the flux capacitor and has, you know, 88 on the back, which is a number that plays so heavily. It's just kind of an odd series of coincidences that I wonder how many of those were somehow intentional or were just entirely unintentional.
Well, the last time I revisited this movie, I actually noticed that, but I thought it was an homage. I somehow had forgotten that I thought Banzai came out in 86. So as I'm watching it this time and seeing these things, I just thought, oh, well, that's a fun homage. And then I realized, no, wait, this was a year before Back to the Future. That's interesting. But I want to say this about W.D. Richter, because, again, he directed this one. He wrote Big Trouble in Little China. And his movies, the things that he's kind of created here with directing this one and writing Big Trouble is that they look like blockbusters, they sound like blockbusters, they move like blockbusters, but with a complete lack of adherence to anything that could be classified as formula. Like, they have everything else that a blockbuster should have, and yet story formula, you know, rigorous adherence to, like, this has to happen here, and we need this kind of character, we need that to happen. You know, it's very much like when you watch Guardians of the Galaxy, it's like, I mean, yeah, it has its big, you know, there's a thing crashing at the surface of a planet Marvel ending, but beyond that, there's nothing in that movie that makes you go, oh, well, this had to happen here. Of course that happens. Everything that happens, you're just like, oh, well, that's kind of a refreshing surprise.
Well, it's interesting. It's he's one of those screenwriters that really understands what he's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he adheres very much to formula in both of those films, but the formula is the formula that he's adhering to is he's got classic three-act structure, and he understands that, but he has all that stuff happening in the background and kind of dragging the characters along, because what those films really are is character movies. They're comedies mm-hmm. about these characters. And when you look back at both of those movies, it's not about the events that transpire. It's the characters. It's the exact same way with Guardians of the Galaxy, which is why I thought both of these films were great comparisons for Guardians of the Galaxy, because Guardians of the Galaxy is a film in which, the plot of the film is wafer thin, and it's wafer thin in the way these are. Alien, you know, Buckaroo Banzai accidentally lets out some aliens. He crosses the barrier. The aliens know they can get back home because they accidentally came through before, and they want to go back, and other aliens are going to stop them. And in Big Trouble, it's a very similar plot. There's this big baddie alien or this big baddie ghost yeah. who wants to become a mortal again, and has to go through the events of doing this thing. And then a bunch of other guys, drag our hero into it, by accident, trying to stop them. Mm-hmm. And in both situations, they are put in, you know, these protagonists are put in situations where they have to go and do battle with this bad guy in what are very, you know, that all of the circumstances of it are tropes, and they're mm-hmm. tropes of classic Monomyth or classic, in the case of Big Trouble, it's definitely Monomyth, but in Buckaroo Banzai, it's totally just like we were talking about before, you know, classic kind of cliffhanger stuff, very, Doc Savage, very, very comic booky, that structure. But these movies are essentially character comedies, and they are about how funny it is to watch Buckaroo Banzai and his buddies triumph over these things with all of these things at their disposal that you just don't know they have. And there are lots of subtle little in jokes. And one of my favorites from Buckaroo Banzai is the constant reference to strike teams. Mm-hmm. You want to strike, no strike teams.
No strike teams.
And then by the end, it's like, why were they you know, what's the thing with the strike teams? And it's like, all right, we need strike teams. And so you, at that point, you don't question that, oh, hey, yeah, Buckaroo Banzai has strike teams to go in to take out this alien base. He adheres to the structure only in as much as he needs to, mm-hmm. to have these characters do things that surprise you. And that's where all the surprises come in, is because his characters are refreshing, and they make the underlying structure of it feel refreshing as well as a result.
Yeah. And you know, it's a quote from Richter in an interview talking about this movie, and he said, normally Hollywood wouldn't let you make that movie. It's a fluke. And I feel like we are returning to an era where that fluke may end up. I mean, the thing about Buckaroo Banzai, I mean, we're talking about it in comparison to Guardians of the Galaxy, is that Guardians of the Galaxy is a huge smash hit financially. Buckaroo Banzai, unfortunately, was a financial bomb, but exactly as Siskel predicted at the time of its release, it has since become a cult sensation. And I find that very interesting, in that we have somehow come full circle, it feels like, with Guardians, where it's like these type of movies that we loved because they were so weird, these 80s movies that we love because they're so weird, but didn't really give any... It's not as if we ever watched these movies and thought, man, I really think this will have mass appeal. And I think that's why I like it, is because it has so much mass appeal. Like, no, we didn't care one way or the other whether these films had mass appeal. All we knew is that they spoke to us.
Yeah.
And they cut through, and they like had a direct line into our brains.
Yeah. Well, I think the most analogous film, I think comparing Buckaroo Banzai, kind of lives in the same kind of, subgenre of film as Guardians, but I think the most analogous film to Guardians in particular is Ghostbusters, because it's that kind of mammoth cultural thing that was just weird. It was just absurd enough that the audiences are like, I have no idea what this is, but I'm on board because You know, they, you know, with Ghostbusters, it was, they had a connection with Bill Murray because he was a huge comedic actor at the time. You know, he's still, you know, he's still, he's Bill fucking Murray.
Yeah.
But, he was a big draw at the time. He had, had a number of big comedy hits. Several people who had been involved with those hits were involved in this. And everyone was like, well, shit, we got, we'll give this a shot. And of course, then everybody's like, holy fuck, everybody loved Ghostbusters and it was huge. And mm-hmm. the soundtrack did really well. And here, that's exactly what we're seeing with Guardians. People are like, well, I don't, you know, I don't know what this is, but it's a Marvel movie and they don't really steer me wrong very often. Mm-hmm. And I'm on board. So let's go see it. And then they're like, oh my God, this is awesome. And then they do like you do, you did, and go home and listen to the soundtrack and, mm-hmm. you know, download, the awesome mix. And, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, you know, you're hearing Redbone on the radio again. And so it's, I think that's the most analogous film. Well, and
I think it's analogous in terms of its potential as a pop culture mainstay. I actually have, in terms of structure, a film that I think it resembles pretty eerily, and we'll talk about that next week. But I want to talk really quickly about the look of this film, because what most people don't know about The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension is that there was a lot of turmoil in getting it made, and specifically because of one producer. And the look of the film itself was something that was affected by this. So Richter wanted the film to have rich color and texture, so they hired a director of photography named Jordan Cronenweth, who you may, well, I mean, he's just the guy who shot Blade Runner, for crying out loud. But for some reason, there was a producer named David Begelman who kind of at every step of the way, I mean, if you listen to W.D. Richter talk about it, every step of the way was sort of sabotaging the movie or making decisions that didn't seem in the movie's best interest. So one of the things he did is he, for some reason, replaces Cronenweth with Fred J. Konenkamp, who, to his credit, had shot things like Patton, The Amityville Horror, The Towering Inferno, but at that time he was doing mostly totally forgettable TV movies, and that's apparently what gave Buckaroo Banzai a more flat, campy Vermeer to it. But what I find interesting about that move, and I don't know if this was, if Begelman knew this, or if it just happened to be happenstance, but he shot the only feature film version of Doc Savage. So one of his credits as a director of photography is that, you know, it's completely forgettable big screen adaptation, but it's the only one that exists.
Yeah.
And Konenkamp just happened to be the guy who shot that movie. And then, of course, that's the pulp novel that that largely inspired Buckaroo Banzai. And, you know, there's been talk now of this. It's been rumored for a long time. I don't know if it's true, if we'll ever see it, about a new Doc Savage film with Chris Hemsworth as the star and Shane Black as the director.
Well, it's definitely true. Shane Black has been working on it for years. The question is whether a studio will finally pull the trigger on it and give the funding to that movie. But Shane has been talking about that movie for a long time. He's been wanting to make Doc Savage forever and got the rights to it. And in the wake of Iron Man 3, was able to get interest generated in it again. And now we're all just kind of crossing our fingers, hoping that it actually happens. Because if anybody can make that movie, it's Shane Black.
And speaking of things for which we're holding our breath, we teased it a bit before, but let's talk about the Buckaroo Banzai sequel that never was, which yes. is to the end of the film. Which,
there's two aspects to this.
Well, at the end of the film, this film has one of the most memorable. Again, it's weird. It's campy. It kind of is at odds with the rest of the movie, but also kind of perfectly gels with it.
The greatest credit sequence of all time.
The greatest credit sequence of all time, where here you got all of the members of the cast, characters that are both living and dead by the end of the movie.
All the heroes.
Yes, I should say all the heroes. Some of whom have passed on, but are just back for this. Are starting to basically form up as this music plays this very like jaunty little tune. And they're walking through a Los Angeles aqueduct, and they're kind of just almost like in Reservoir Dogs, like coming together. But they're dancing, and it's very upbeat and happy. And
they're all in lockstep. They're all moving. They're walking towards the screen. They're joining from off screen. It is. If you are a fan of Buckaroo Banzai, it is just watching that sequence, just hearing that song, just makes you happy because it's everything that is. It encapsulates everything that's great about this movie and about what the whole point of the movie is.
Yeah.
And it's such a great, and then they, you know, we cut shots and they walk past us and we stop right at some graffiti of Buckaroo Banzai written on the side of the aqueduct wall. And it's a fabulous. It really was one of those really inspired kind of things.
And to his credit, this is something that Begelman actually asked for, because they were just going to end the film on a kiss. And he's like, well, let's end it with some kind of choreography. But then also in keeping with his feelings about the film, was like, let's do that because nobody's going to see this anyway. Like, he basically was very negative about the movie the entire time and fought with Richter about every single thing. But I find it interesting that, as you know, during the production when they were filming that scene, the music wasn't done. They had no score. That song, nobody had heard. So instead, they're walking around to Uptown Girl by Billy Joel. As they're filming this movie, they're listening to, there's a boombox on the back of the camera truck just blaring Uptown Girl. So it ended up working out, but what they're dancing and step to is actually Billy Joel's Uptown Girl.
Because why wouldn't you?
Because
back in the 80s, that's what you did.
Indeed. And then we're told that Buckaroo Banzai will return in Buckaroo Banzai
and the World Crime League.
Versus the World Crime League. And obviously, at the time, it was like, yeah, fuck yeah, can't wait to see that. And we never did. But the thing is, a lot of people have speculated that that was a joke. Like, oh, well, they never intended to do a sequel. The fact of the matter is, they actually did.
Yeah.
Sherwood Studios believed in this movie. And they were fully prepared, if Buckaroo Banzai had made money, to do that sequel. But they had to work with Begelman, who at the time was the head of MGM, and did not believe in the movie at all. And as a consequence, there's actually probably a lot of factors that went into this being not a mainstream hit. And then in the meantime, Sherwood Studios goes bankrupt. And then a few years later, Begelman ends up committing suicide. And then all of a sudden, you have a rights limbo with this movie that means no other studio can snatch it away and do, even though you probably had people all over the business going, yeah, let's do this, let's Buckaroo Banzai sequel. The problem is now the rights are tied up into bankruptcy and basically the fallout of MGM after their CEO suicide. So there's like all kinds of red tape. And that's actually why it took so long for us to even get a DVD of this movie.
Yeah.
It was in this rights limbo for so long. But now, it absolutely was going to have a sequel. That absolutely was the plan before Sherwood Studios went bankrupt.
And as a result, a member of fandom who has since become quite notable in fandom, a gentleman from here in Austin named Ernie Klein,
mm-hmm.
Who wrote the great, the fantastic book Ready Player One, and the, let's call it the cult favorite, Fanboys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of Fanboys, but I know a lot of people aren't. But I love it, and I really love Ready Player One. He wrote a version of Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League that you can find online. If you Google it, you can find it. He kind of threw it out there years ago. It wasn't a paid gig. It was something that he wrote for himself. And most Buckaroo Banzai fans I know consider it to be the true sequel. Like that Ernie really kind of nailed what's awesome about Buckaroo Banzai, and that people have wanted to see that script get made. And so if you are a Buckaroo Banzai fan and you are a fan of reading scripts, definitely seek out Ernie's take on that. Cause it's a fun little movie. It's kind of interesting. There are a couple moments or lines from that script that had snuck into my head as being from Buckaroo Banzai. And when I sat down to watch it again, I was like, wait, where is that? Oh God. Yeah. That was from the Ernie script. Yeah. No, that's not in the Buckaroo Banzai movie.
That's just, deep tracks nerdery right there.
No, when you sit and read that script, you hear Peter Weller saying those lines. So of course, you know, it's you could totally see him doing that performance, and then it's like, oh wait, that doesn't actually exist. It only kind of exists in this dream space a bunch of us share. But it's definitely worth seeking out.
Almost exactly 2 years ago to the day of this posting, W.D. Richter seemed confident that they could still make a sequel to Buckaroo Banzai. And
I'm sure Peter Weller will do it.
I can't imagine Peter Weller saying no to that. And that's that's kind of the great thing about the cast that they had. I mean, Vincent Schiavelli has unfortunately passed away. I don't know if
most of the major cast is still,
not only still alive, but because there were so many character actors and not huge headline marquee stars, that's not outside the realm of possibility, I suppose.
But how will they find a way to bring Clancy Brown back?
They'll have to find a way to bring Clancy Brown back.
You need Clancy Brown.
Hey, I'm going to stop you. Every movie needs the Kurgan.
Every movie needs Clancy Brown. Some movies just need a little more Clancy Brown than others.
Some need more shades of brown, and then some need less.
Don't put it that way.
I did actually put it that way. There's nothing you can do about that. I think what's really interesting, too, is that one of the things that Richter and Begelman fought about was in that prologue, the home video prologue. Like, Begelman hated the home video prologue, just wanted it gone entirely. And I'm not sure, but I think that what happened was in the now you have to remember this movie came out when I was born, so I didn't see it in theaters. But
from what I've
been reading, and if you remember this, let me know, Cargill. But that sequence, that opening prologue home video thing, was that actually in the theatrical version?
That I could not honestly tell you because I watched the movie about a billion times on HBO, as many of us did, and those kind of bleed together. So okay. I don't remember ever seeing a version without it, but that's only because I saw it with it so many times that it, you know, it that's what it is.
And it's become sort of jumbled up in like the special edition DVD, what you saw on HBO and the theatrical version, but from what I've been researching, it appears that Begelman had that entire opening prologue taken out because he didn't like the fact that they were referring to a villain named Hanoi Zan who doesn't appear in the movie. And the specific reason for the reference at the beginning was that, again, they were planning to do this sequel. And Hanoi Zan was going to factor in to the sequel. So you have like a cinematic universe that is already being built, much in the same way that after 2008, Marvel started looking at all of its superhero films as we need to build one giant cinematic universe. Buckaroo Banzai, as weird as it is, as an anomaly of a sci-fi film as it is already thinking about the larger scope of it with its sequels and how it's going to build that universe, which I think is really interesting. As is the fact that in that prologue, his mother is played by Jamie Lee Curtis. And she has no lines. You wouldn't really know it to look at her, but she is Buckaroo Banzai's mother in that prologue. So, but as far as I can tell, that was completely excised from the theatrical version, has been since put back for the TV versions and, of course, the special edition DVD. And again, all of this kind of factoring into why it took so long to get a DVD in the first place. And also on this most recent viewing, I noticed something that I had never seen before. The hospital orderly in charge of Lizardo is Jonathan Banks, who's better known as Breaking Bad's Mike Ehrmantraut, and then, of course, Professor Hickey in the most recent seasons of Community.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, well, there's just for shits and giggles, here's yet another character actor that I know and love. It's just that's part of the greatness of this movie is around every turn is something weird and something wonderful, and the overall effect is that it's just a movie that makes you happy. Yeah. You know, and it's again, it's very
and by design, because it really is above all what W.D. Richter was doing was he was writing comedies. Mm-hmm. And but they were comedies in which the characters actually believed that they were in real danger. You know, they really did buy into their own universes, even when you were supposed to be laughing at them.
Right. I absolutely love this movie. And much like I was saying before, it's very equatable to the experience of the first time Rocket jumps up on Groot and Groot's smacking things with his branches and Rocket's firing. That scene just makes me so happy because it exists. I'm like, this movie exists. And in this moment, I am very hyper aware that I am fortunate enough to live in a dimension where this film exists. And that's very much the same with Buckaroo Banzai. Every time I watch it, I'm like, I am so glad to live on a planet in a dimension where this film got made, despite all of the problems that it had, despite the infighting, despite the fact that we never got a sequel, despite the fact that it was a complete financial disaster. It got made, it exists, and nobody can take that away from me. Yeah. And that makes me very happy.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I kind of want to go to the alternate reality where all of those 80s movies that advertised their sequels coming out actually had their sequels and see what that was like. Because that was actually, you know, that's something I want to talk about earlier. That was actually something that happened for a couple years in movies, is in the credits, they would advertise the coming sequel, and then they would never happen. There were a number of films that I remember. Class Act was one of them.
Class Act?
Yeah.
Really?
Watch the credits for Class Act. They promise in the credits that the two characters are going to be back next summer in another Zany Wild Adventure. Sword and the Sorcerer.
Yeah.
Of course, Albert Pune's classic.
Albert Pune and classic in the same sentence is a hard pill to swallow. But
except Sword and the Sorcerer is the only one you could actually use that for, because you certainly can't say that about Captain America.
No, you can't say that about Captain America, but I do want to point out that you are basically saying that you want to live in a universe where Kitten Plays Class Act has a sequel.
Oh, no, not that one.
Wait, no. not the Kid and Play Class Act?
Not the Kid and Play one. The one from, I believe the title's Class Act, from like 81 or 82. Yeah, no, not Class Act. Okay, Making the Grade. That's okay.
Yeah, that's a little better. I could live in a world where
for some reason, for years, I've had that in my head called Class Act. And no, it's not Class Act. It's Making the Grade. But that's because it's one of the, like, you're looking at that film and you're like, what the fuck is that movie? I've not seen this movie.
I thought you just were like really excited by the House Party franchise and wanted to see all the Kid and Play properties get their own cinematic universe.
I kind of would like to. I kind of want to live in that universe too. That's the one with President Vanilla Ice, right?
That's the darkest timeline.
Go Ninja, Go.
That's the darkest timeline.
Go Ninja, Go.
Where the only version of Rebel Without a Cause is cool as ice. Yeah, that is the darkest timeline, Cargill.
That's the best version of Rebel Without a Cause.
It is a version of Rebel Without a Cause, that's for sure.
Why don't you drop the zero and get with the hero?
Oh.
Why have we not done... Oh, that's why.
No.
Because we don't do irony.
No, we don't. We've taken a very hard line against irony.
Cool as ice is so bad.
Oh, it's bad.
Yeah, it's no bueno. But yeah, so don't take that. And don't take that as an endorsement of any of those other films.
Don't do that.
Except maybe at some point we need to talk Sword and the Sorcerer.
Yes,
Sword
absolutely.
Sword and the Sorcerer is kind of awesome. But yeah, but all of these films, you know, they had these little tags at the end. They're like, hey, watch next year when this movie's coming out, and those movies never come out, and you're just like, where's my Sword and the Sorcerer sequel, Pune?
Yeah, and, Pune.
Oh God. And eventually it took 30 years, but we got it.
Do you remember when we were supposed to get a Masters of the Universe sequel and it just became Jean-Claude Van Damme's Cyborg?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, that was, they had already built the sets, and then it did not take off. And they're like, well, what do we do? Make a movie called Cyborg. Right.
I think we've just written the synopsis for a future episode where we talk about alternate timelines, which is one of my favorite things to discuss. But of course, with Buckaroo Banzai, we've come to the end of the show, and that's my favorite part, and that is the junk food pairing. So, you remember when you used to go with your family to a buffet-style restaurant, be it Sizzler, be it Ryan's, whatever? The best part of the meal was always, always the frozen yogurt bar, because they would amass toppings for your froyo that no human being would ever seek out on a daily basis as a suitable topper for frozen yogurt. I mean, yes, they would
like roast beef and fried chicken.
Yeah. No, they would have like the Jimmy's.
That was the bar, right?
No. They would have like, you know, the Jimmy's, and they would have the walnuts, and they would have like
the cookie
crumbles. But no, then they would have gummy bears, gumdrops, jelly beans, all the shit that no human being should want to put on ice cream. And yet, in that one glorious moment of pure joy, you wanted to consume it all at once, and somehow, in that moment, it tasted all the better for the hodgepodge. And I think that's exactly what Buckaroo Banzai is. It's a bunch of things that really should not work together, but in that one moment, in that viewing, it all gels, and it's made better for the hodgepodge. So definitely the frozen yogurt bar at any of these innumerable buffet establishments, especially when you were a kid, that is the experience of watching Buckaroo Banzai for me.
Curse are you, Banzai!
So that's going to bring us to the end of the episode. Before we go, I do want to, as I always do, ask you, Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com/massawyrm, MASSAWYRM, or at on Facebook. You can check out my Facebook page under C. Robert Cargill. You can also find my books in stores. My latest book, Queen of the Dark Things, is out, which is a sequel to
Class Act,
otherwise known as Dreams and Shadows. And of course, if you're in the Chicago area, keep your eyes peeled, because Sinister 2 starts production here within the weeks.
Is that filming in Chicago?
They're filming in Chicago. So if you see trucks running around, you see things shooting, you just might spy a certain junk food aficionado standing on the sidelines overseeing, watching something. I was going to say overseeing, but they're not letting me oversee shit. They just let me watch. So
overseeing would suggest you have any say at that point.
But that's where you can find me right now.
Fair enough. Well, you can find me on the Twitters as well, at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me over at oneofus.net, doing podcasts, writing articles, just managing shit as best I can. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisbury, because that is my name. And again, I want to remind you that we'll have the link to the movie Buckaroo Banzai right here below the podcast that you're listening to on Film School Rejects. And if you click on that and you buy it, or if you click on it, get to Amazon and buy anything, we get a cut of that purchase, and it really does support the show, and we appreciate it. But that's going to do it for this week. So for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that the fourth dimension is not the same as fourth meal.